Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Day player on 720 WGN. I cannot tell you how stoked I am to welcome our first guests tonight. She's a four-time Grammy Award winner who started her career in 1973, and he has been her musical director and partner since 1979, all leading up to their first gold album, Crimes of Passion, in 1980. And they've been together ever since. She sings them, he plays them, and along the way, the union of Pat Benatar and Neil Spider Giraldo have become one of the most successful in music history, and their legacy continues to be celebrated across the globe. And joining us to talk about their nearly four-decade-long journey are rock legends, and yes, I'm going to say it, folks, future Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, and that's Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo. Pat and Spider, welcome in.
Thank you. How you doing?
How you doing today?
I am excellent. And yes, I'm going to say it, future Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. We got to make that happen. Well,
that would be nice.
That would be nice. Well, I'll tell you, 35 years of working together, playing together, living life together, and I'm going to coin the phrase and be a big geek here, but say love is a battlefield. So far, you guys have won the war. I don't know how you do it. My wife and I could not work together. We love each other. We love spending time with each other. We couldn't do it. There must be some secrets to make that all work.
Well, there is a secret, but if I told you, it wouldn't be a secret. So I can't really do that. But you know what? We both thought the same thing before we met. Yeah. But, you know, we didn't, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. It was kind of the universe playing its hand for us, and we were each other's muse, and thankfully, we became each other's lover right away. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
But he's really nice, too, so that really helps.
She's really nice, too.
You're
really
so helped. Full of it.
That's funny. Spoken like a true married couple. First, I want to dig into this. First with Pat, you know, I know you started singing in grammar school, but you were about 20 years old, and I read this, you were like a bank teller, and you were inspired by a concert you attended to pursue a career in music. What was that concert like? What came about there?
I was with a bunch of my fabulous gay friends, and they were going to see Liza Minnelli, and I was working in a bank, and I'd stopped singing, you know, I just was studying voice and everything, but I stopped singing, and you know, I just you know, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do with my life. I was, you know, 19 years old, 20 years old, and I was living in Richmond, Virginia, and they wanted to go to a concert. They wanted to go see Liza Minnelli, and they said, sure, why not? I loved her mother, let's go. But when I was there and I was just sitting in the seats before the show started, I just was looking around and thinking, wow, this is pretty incredible. And you know, it was in the Richmond Coliseum, so it was about, you know, 18,000 people. And she came out and she started singing, doing her thing. And I was thinking, wow, I can do this. I know I can do this. If she can do this, I can do this.
Right.
And that kind of it.
That was kind of it. Now, I know, you know, you sang for a couple of years. You sang with a lounge band called Coxon's Army. What kind of music was that?
It was just all covers, basically. The guy who was the band leader, he wrote some original stuff. But it was really basically a pop band, and it did all cover songs and things like that. You know, it was a bar band. That was it. But it wasn't doing any rock and roll stuff. I mean, I was always trying, but, you know, those guys were kind of, they were kind of middle of the road. So, but I was just happy to be working. So it was good.
I know the band broke up. You drove to New York and you went on stage at open mic night at Catch a Rising Star. What did you sing? What kind of kicked it off that got you discovered?
Nothing that had anything to do with what it ended up as. I sang Rockabye Your Baby. Because like I said, I love Judy Garland, so I sang that. That's what I sang, and everyone went crazy, and it just went from there. But I mean, it had absolutely nothing to do with what I wanted to do. I was just, you know, so schooled in classical music and theatrical music. So I just picked what I knew, and that's what I did. So,
you know, and I know you did a little Broadway, too, at the time, some off-Broadway stuff. It was with Beverly D'Angelo, who I had on the show, by the way, a couple months ago, and Christine Lottie. And you also created, you know, you created a look for yourself that kind of defined who Pat Benatar is.
Yeah, that was just a Halloween costume that just evolved, and it worked. It was just an idea. We went out on Halloween, and we went back up to catch, but we stayed in our costumes, and I performed that night in the costume that I wore, and it just had such a reaction that I thought, maybe I should try this again the next night. So I did, and I kept doing it over and over again, and then it evolved, and it became what everybody recognizes as the beginning thing, and,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
it was fun. It was crazy. You know, we're 25 years old. How old are you, Spider? 22?
21. When you were 25, I was 21.
Yeah.
So you went a little younger on
Pat.
Yeah.
You know, you were just doing crazy. And then and we met. You know, then everything started to solidify, and we started to really hone in on what we were doing, and that's when it really got, you know, to where it is what you all know now.
Yeah. Well, I know you were doing some jingles. You were working with advertisers. You were performing in clubs, and you got this record deal with Chrysalis. And now you also met with this record deal. All came along a very important person in your life, and that's Spider. Now, Spider, how did you and Pat meet? What do you remember from that first time?
I was playing with Rick Derringer at the time, and we were on an American tour. We did Canada as well, but we were on the road, and what happened was I finished doing a record for Rick. I played most piano on it because I played a lot of piano as well. And then I was told of a singer that got signed to a record company that wanted to form a rock and roll band. I was looking for a partner. And the person that was scheduled to produce the record, after a failed attempt by another producer, says, well, I know this young guy because he's finished a record with Rick Derringer. That's me. He says, I want you to go and meet this person. I just had no idea it was going to be a girl. I says, maybe I've heard of him before. And he didn't know you didn't hear him because it's a her. And I went, oh. So I was sent down basically to meet Patricia and to talk over the idea of forming a band because she wasn't in any type of rock and roll band at that time. So and then I heard a voice, and I says, well, you got such a good voice. I hope I don't ruin it by rock. A little bit, too. But, you know, of course, it held up great. So that's kind of how it
happened. How did we meet?
How did we meet? Well, that's it. We met at SIR in New York City. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was on my way back to Cleveland, and that's where I was from.
Right.
I had some time off because I finished the record with Rick, and I was going to go on the road with him shortly, like after a couple months. So I had a little time off. So I was on my way to the airport, and the record company called and said, listen, just signed this girl. You know, I heard about you. We'd love for you to come down and meet her. And that's what I did. I drove down. I says, well, if I don't get along with her, if it don't work out, can I get another ticket back to Cleveland because I'll miss my flight? He says,
yeah.
Not only will I give you a ticket back, if it don't, he says, I will put you in a hotel because it will work.
That's awesome. That's the confidence level they had. Well, Pat's from New York. You're from Cleveland. Spider, what are some of the music that was inspiring you when you were just a kid?
Well, there was quite a bit. One was my Uncle Tim, who basically lived with me at my parents' house. He was 4 years older than me, and he got me into all the early British guitar-driven rock bands like the Kinks and then the Who and, you know, on and on, the Yardbirds. So those bands really affected me as a guitar player. And then I loved Chuck Berry, but I liked the piano almost a little bit more than the guitar, which is odd to say. So that fueled my piano stuff. And then I had a lot of blues things that I got to because my mother would take me to five and dime stores, and for 99 cents I can buy 10 45 records.
Right, you sure could.
I never knew what the inside was. I knew what the outside was. Well, I didn't even know who those were. So I was listening to Muddy Waters and Johnny Hooker. I had no idea who these people were.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
They all played a part into the thing. You know, part of the beauty of our relationship that works so well is we're coming from two diverse places of music.
Right.
And
right.
That's what makes it so special for us, because by joining, we pull each other both into the middle. And that's the special thing that makes it work for us.
Spider, when did you start playing? How old were you?
I was 6 years old for guitar. I was 10 years old for piano. And then I started beating drums when I was about 13.
Now, Pat, who were some of your inspirations growing up?
In popular music and rock and roll, it was definitely Led Zeppelin and John Lennon. But I liked a lot of the Motown stuff. I liked the showmanship of all that Motown stuff and the harmonies and,
yeah.
You know, a lot of the melodic stuff that was going on with Motown. And then, of course, you know, I was studying opera. So, I mean, you know, all of that. I mean, that gave me all the stamina and the strength and the, you know, the range
technique.
And everything. Yeah, all the technique that I needed to do, which I had no idea it was going to help me, but it actually did.
Right.
And, you know, I loved theatrical music. I was in a lot of productions in that way, and I still do. You know, Spider, we've been married 33 years, and he still can't believe he's married to a woman who lives in the South Pacific in the car. You know what I mean?
So, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, and I know, too, you know, you played Spider with so many other artists over the years too, Kenny Loggins and John Waite, but this was an enduring friendship and a relationship that not only melded professionally but personally as well. But it helped kick off that first album, and I think this might be surprising to everybody, but I mean every album since. I mean you've really been together from the very beginning, and the first album was In the Heat of the Night, which included Heartbreaker and We Live for Love. I mean that was a big album.
Yeah, that was a big one. Well, see, when I was introduced to Patricia, she didn't have a band. There was nobody there. She was signed, and the record company basically said, you know, listen, if you got a song, just do it together. The management used the term musical director, but musical director is so, I always felt that was a term that should be like Janet Jackson would have a musical director. Rock bands don't have musical directors. They have a guitar player and a singer.
Gotcha.
And they form the band. So what we did is, once we met and we both understood where we were going to go with this thing, then we called in a bunch of musicians and we formed the band to take it out from New York to California.
We just worked together right from the hat. I mean, even if they weren't actually getting it, which they weren't, you know, I'd explained it like 8 billion times that I was going to do, try to be, you know, like Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and, you know, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. I wanted this partnership on stage so I wasn't just some, you know, solo female artist.
Sure.
On stage. You know, they really were not getting it. They had an idea in their mind, but the point is it didn't matter because Spider and I had the idea, and we started from that point. And everything that we did as a duo. You know, unfortunately, in the beginning, it wasn't portrayed like that, but, you know, we spent many, many years, you know, clarifying that.
Sure.
So that everybody would really understand what it really meant.
You're the right kind of singer.
So guys, here comes the first gold album, and it was really the second album. I mean, that's pretty groundbreaking as it is. Crimes of Passion, and some major, major hits that really blew you guys out of the box, which, of course, was the big hit, Hit Me With Your Best Shot. It was your first top 10 hit.
Yeah, that was crazy. That was a gold single. Crimes of Passion went multi-platinum 5 times, and even Heat of the Night went platinum, so it was really, it was exciting. I mean, it was just, you know, I mean, it was a little unnerving because, you know, we'd only been together a short time,
right.
And everything started to accelerate really, you know, quickly. And we made Heat of the Night in 28 days.
Yeah,
28
wow.
days.
Wow.
And we went right on the road, and the record just, you know, went crazy, and
sure.
Heartbreaker was, you know, climbing up the charts. So we spent the next, you know, 3 years chasing ourselves because we had to go back in and we made Crimes of Passion, and that just cemented everything, and it went insane. So, I mean, it was really exciting, but it was really crazy. And
I bet.
Well, Crimes of Passion was a good second record to make because what it was 8 months or 7 months of being on the road with the same band,
mm-hmm.
not just a formed band to go in the studio. So
sure.
That we basically translated the live band sound to the record, and that's kind of what we were going for, which was kind of easy because we did that fast as well. So that was a good thing for the right time.
But it didn't give us any time to worry about, like, the sophomore jinx. There was no time for that.
Right.
So it was really great because you had no fear. not because you were arrogant or anything, but it never even occurred to you there was no time to be afraid.
So right, yeah.
You just went in there and did it, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And that's, I think that's what makes that sophomore album so much more special, especially what you say, Neil, about the whole thing that you guys got to know each other. You got to know how to play with each other. There was a feeling there, and you knew how, by that point, you knew how to do it. And you took a little more time on this album, not 28 days, but you took a little more time to spend on something.
A little bit more, not much.
Not much, but there was a synergy, you know? I mean, it was happening from playing. We were out on the road for almost 14 months. It was a long time.
No.
So.
No, we did that in I think it was in March or April of 1980. We were only on the road for like 4 or 5 months.
5 months, yeah. But the whole year, that year, we were on for sure.
Yeah, and actually, when that record finished, we finished that record. That's when Rick Springfield called me up and said, hey, could come in the studio. I want you to do a couple songs for me. And that's where Jesse's Girl came from.
Yeah, it was a pretty electric time.
Crazy time. Well, speaking of that, like, when did you feel like you made it? Like, was it the first album? Was it the second one? Was it the first top 10 single? Was it the album going gold? I know it was the Grammy. You both were on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. Like, what made you say, holy cow, we're here?
It started even with Heat of the Night, because, you know, you have to remember, back then there was no internet or any of that stuff, so you had to wait every week to find out when Billboard came out, and you got a day lead time on where your album was, but you literally had to wait for that magazine to come out, and so you would wait, you know, every week, and it was going up the charts, but we were so, you know, focused and busy because we were touring. I mean, we were playing, I don't know, 5-6 shows a week. It was insane. But we drove up, one time we were in Virginia Beach, and we drove up to this club. You have to understand, we're still playing clubs at this point. And it was, you know, very soon after the record was released, but we drove up to this club, and there were all these people. There were barricades, and people were throwing things, and they were running all over the place. There were cops everywhere, and I'm thinking, oh, what could possibly have happened? And it was because the club had oversold the seats, and people were going crazy because they couldn't get in.
Wow.
And I think for me, that was the moment I was like,
And then it just accelerated from then.
Yeah, it went crazy.
It just went quick. But, you know, one funny thing is that we had a, you know, of course, we're living together, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Toyota that was rented because our business manager told us, after the record went gold, the business manager said, Heat of the Night went gold. He says, don't get too full of yourself. Just, you can't afford a new car yet.
We rented a car.
We rented a Toyota.
That's awesome. Well,
shared it.
Yeah. I was going to say that probably kept you grounded, right?
We were pretty grounded.
We were really grounded.
I think they kept us working so much that they didn't want us to ever start to think.
That's awesome.
And it worked out.
It worked out okay.
It was a record every 9 months.
Yeah.
If you look at the history of it.
I saw that,
One record, nine months.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, and then out of this album, too, came, you know, Treat Me Right, Hell Is for Children, and a song that made its debut on MTV, You Better Run. I want you to tell us that story.
Yeah, well, You Better Run was we recorded that for the Rudy soundtrack.
Right.
And that was the first thing we did after Heat of the Night. We didn't do the record for Crimes of Passion yet,
album.
Right.
Okay.
We said You Better Run. And we just finished that song and was put on that roadie soundtrack.
Right.
And then we got the word that there's a new music station coming out. And we did a video, but we had no idea what we were doing.
People said, we're going to start doing these things. They're like videos. They're going to. Yeah. It was a lot. You know, the only thing that you could ever do that was like that was to go on Midnight Special or rock concert or, you know,
Saturday Night Live or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you just basically, they said, we're gonna shoot this. You don't have to be on the show. We're just gonna shoot a video of you performing the song, and we were like, okay. So we were in this like warehouse, you know, we're like shooting this thing, and we're just performing. It was a performance video, and it was, you know, all for the idea that this television station was starting, this cable station called MTV, and they only had 5 videos when they started, and we were number 2. So it was. It was pretty incredible. It changed everything. In about 10 days, we couldn't go anywhere anymore.
I bet. Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah, the first band was really the synthesized band.
Right.
You know, so we come out. I think when MTV, when they wrote their book and they talked about it, they said they liked the song You Better Run because they wanted to send the message to the record either radio or record companies to say you better run because video is going to take
over. Video
is
going to take over.
I don't know what that is. That's even true or not.
Well, video did kill the radio star, but that was a big moment. Not, I mean, you think about that. Not only a big moment for you guys, but it was a big moment in music history. I mean, that was to be on MTV.
Yeah,
that's
a lot
of visibility.
It was so crazy. I remember when we saw it the first time. We were in a little motel. You know, it was the beginning. We didn't have any money, so we're going to do Oklahoma, a big festival there, and we're in this crappy place, and they had MTV, they had the cable station, and we watched it. We sat on the beds, and we couldn't believe it. They played it round the clock. There were no commercials. It was just the VJs talking, and then the five videos that they had, and then they just played them.
Yeah. Well, and then 15 years later, or maybe might even have been more than 15 years, maybe 20 years later, is when somebody said, Spider, that there was a guitar in the first band, and on the MTV.
We didn't even know.
Guitar. I had no idea. I go, okay, whatever. Which is funny for, rock music channel.
Right.
Well,
we didn't even know.
Yeah.
Stuff happens.
Well, I was going to say, Spider, you didn't, people, say you're the guitarist, lead guitarist, but I mean, you played other instruments besides the guitar. I mean, you were on the piano, and plus you were doing all those things behind the scenes as well. I mean, you were really... and I say this, you were kind of the Desi Arnaz also with Lucy, because he did all the production stuff as well and played a bunch of hands.
Everything.
I act more like Lucy.
You have to be Lucy, but he definitely did everything. I mean, he did all the grunt work. You know, he did it. He was in there. He was the mad scientist. You know, and I was his muse, and I would come in there and, throw in my parts, but he would be in there, 16, 18 hours a day. He was
because I cared about a song most. That's the most important thing. I wasn't self-serving ever. In fact, the record company at one point says, will you please start playing more guitar? At one point, they said, you're playing too much. They said, can you play more? Because I'm more interested in the song.
He was always a producer. He didn't even know that. I mean, he began as the guitarist, but he just... The minute he realized what production meant and all of the creativity that went with it and how, you could really, form, ideas and all of that stuff that goes on in his head all day. I mean, it was a perfect venue for him. And he just took to it, like it was so natural.
2 multi-platinum albums, 5 platinum albums, 3 gold albums, 19 top 40 singles, including top 10 hits. And for more on Pat and Spider, you can visit Benatar Giraldo, and that's giraldo.com. Pat, Spider, man, this was a lot of fun. I am looking forward to seeing you this week.
That'd be great.
Thanks,
Dave.
We're looking forward to coming.
All right, thanks again. Much more ahead on 720 WGN. She's an innovator on the music scene and named by Rolling Stone magazine as one of the greatest guitarists of all time. Joining us is Joan Jett and Kenny Laguna.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Excellent. Hey, thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So, Joan, I want to talk to you about how it all started for you. So you got your first guitar, and that was really the beginning of all this.
So I got it like the Christmas when I was 13, yeah.
And what were you being taught at the time? What kind of music were you playing?
I wasn't playing anything. I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the radio, hearing songs like, I remember the song All Right Now by The Free. Mm-hmm. Really was one of the songs that made me want to make those sounds. It was something about the rhythm guitar in that song. It kind of bends slightly out of tune at points, and I don't know, it hit me right in the crotch, but at 13, I didn't know that. It was just something that made me want to learn how to make those sounds. So I asked my parents for an electric guitar for Christmas and was very surprised, pleasantly surprised, and they actually got me one, a Sears Silvertone. And so I went to go take guitar lessons, and, being really excited about it, I wanted the guy to teach me rock and roll the first day. And so I don't know if he was just kind of doing this because I was a girl asking to learn how to play rock and roll, or if this is what he would teach any kid. But he said, no, we got to learn on top of Old Smokey. So he tried to teach me on top of Old Smokey, and I sat through that lesson, and that was the last lesson I took, and I went and bought one of Learn How to Play Guitar by Yourself books and sat down with my records and kind of learned how to play bar chords and would try to learn along with my records. And most of those early ones were things like Black Sabbath or Smoke on the Water was a big one, because the big, fat, easy chords, I think every guitar player learns how to play Smoke on the Water. And so that was probably some of the early things, or Bang a Gong by T-Rex was another big one. And so that's kind of what started me out. And then my family moved from Maryland to California and to the Los Angeles area. And it was at this point that I realized, oh, my God, if I want to be in a band, I could actually really make it happen. In Los Angeles, there must be other people that play instruments. And if I play guitar, there's got to be other girls out here that want to do what I want to do.
And that really opened it up for you. And I know you were hanging out, or a night spot that really caught your attention was Ronnie Bingenheimer's English Disco, right?
Yes. It was a very special place. It was a disco for teenagers. They didn't serve liquor, and if you were over 21, you were just kind of too old. So it was definitely geared towards kids, and they would play all the British singles that American kids never heard. So you'd hear Bowie and a band called The Sweet, or Slade, or Susie Quattro, T-Rex, and just tons of great English music that American kids never heard. 3-minute hit songs with big choruses and hand claps, and it was really catchy stuff. And so that is, you know, kind of inspired me, along with that early stuff that I told you about, with the Deep Purple and Black Sabbath, mixed with the New York Dolls and all this glitter stuff, and that kind of became my style.
And soon, you know, I mean, after that, when you got there, 74, 75, you founded the Runaways with Lita Ford, Jerry Curry, Sandy West, Jackie Fox. It became huge, and you began touring quickly, like with Cheap Trick and Van Halen. Did that success come pretty fast for you?
Well, we played right away. I mean, literally within a month of the Runaways forming, we were doing shows. First, we were a three-piece, and that was in, I'd say, September of 75. And then by that December, we had changed the lineup and auditioned Sheree and Jackie Fox, and we became the five-piece. And, you know, we did go on tour right away, and we had a record deal right away on Mercury Records. So
that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
And, you know, Kim Fowley was handling some of that stuff, so I'm not really quite sure how, that came about. But the touring, we were touring with, we toured with a lot of a variety of bands, you know, everything from, like you said, Van Halen to, you know, Cheap Trick. We did gigs with Cheap Trick while they were playing the material from their first album. So that was like a really special time as well.
I know you had mentioned before, and I've seen some interviews with you before, that you felt like, you know, at the time, the Runaways, you didn't feel like you had a lot of direction. I mean, you were kind of on your own figuring things out.
Yeah, pretty much. We were just, for me, it was all about the gigs. I wasn't really thinking much beyond that, which could have been good or could have been bad. You know, about thinking about my career and what would happen after the Runaways, I just was kind of focused on really what was right in front of me. You know, writing the songs, doing the shows. I wasn't really thinking about the business or how that worked or anything like that. I was since I was one of the songwriters, I did get, you know, money through publishing.
I mean, you were concerned about the music more than itself. You weren't
absolutely
worried about
yeah.
the business end.
That was my main concern, but I wasn't. You know, thinking into the future about, oh, my God, what happens after this band, or, you know, how long can this go on, or anything like that.
But you were young and quite frankly, living for the moment, which you should do at
exactly.
that age.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I know, you know, in the 1970s, and I know you experienced, you know, your fill of sexism in the music industry, you know, girls playing rock and roll, it just doesn't happen. How many times did you hear that?
thousands.
Yeah.
And you still, you know, people don't voice it as much, but it's more, that energy is still out there.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. I mean, you know, you don't see, you know, the music scene has not changed that much. It's not like you've got, you know, girls in bands playing guitar now that are successful. The thing is, they're out there. They're all over the place. They're in every city, every big city, every small town. You've got girls in bands, whether it's an all-girl band or a girl in a band with guys playing rock and roll. They're out there. It's just, you know, I don't. I guess it's got to be sexism. I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. When I started in this, I figured rock and roll is a sort of a free sort of medium. People wouldn't give you crap for playing guitar. You know, they'd be accepting, and I was completely wrong. You know, I thought people would be excited to see girls playing guitars. I was wrong. But I'm not talking about the fans. I'm talking about something within the industry, something within the power structure that doesn't like it.
Yeah.
And I can't really quite pinpoint where that is.
Well,
if it's more than one thing, but, you know, if it's a conglomeration of things, magazines, radio stations, record companies, but it's the girls are out there, so it's quite astounding to me that things have not changed that much in God, now you're saying almost 40 years. You're right.
Yeah, and I'm thinking it's more the labels themselves that just couldn't move the needle on this fast enough, because I know you were told many times, you know, lose the guitar, change your style, your look, everything else. You know, well, the Joan Jett Experience is, you know, the punk rock, glam rock look and the music. I mean, it's a package deal. It all comes together.
Exactly. And girls have testosterone too. So, I mean, you know, they can wail and play rock and roll. You know, it's just down to the individual.
Because the industry rejected Joan, we are one of the few bands on the planet that own big hits.
Yeah,
very few. And Joan's, you know, how many women? I don't know if there's any that own. She owns I Love Rock and Roll. The Rolling Stones don't even own Satisfaction. The Beatles don't own Let It Be. But we own I Love Rock and Roll, and that's only because nobody wanted it.
So. Actually, in a way, it's kind of like the rock and roll gods were looking out for us to kind of to forge this new path. So nobody did sign us, so we own our own music. Then we were kind of forced to, if we wanted our music out, to form our own label. So that created Blackheart Records, which was really the trunk of Kenny's Cadillac for the first several months. And, you know, and now we're the longest-running indie label in America.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, when you sometimes you think a failure is actually a success. And it just goes to show you that you can't, this goes for anybody out there, you know, that you can't believe, if you believe in something, you've got to go for it. Because people told me I had no songs. These are people that listen to I Love Rock and Roll, Crimson and Clover, Do You Want to Touch Me, Bad Reputation, and they say there were no hits. So is that they can't hear hits, or do they have a preconceived notion and didn't even listen to the music? So you can't let people's negativity stop you when people say it. Because people will always say, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this, but why not? And, you know, as long as you're not hurting somebody else, if you don't try something you believe in, and this has to go for anything, not just music. If you want to be an architect or anything, a nuclear physicist, and people are saying, oh, you can't do that, if you don't at least give it a shot, you will always rue the day you didn't go for it. But at least if you go for it and it doesn't turn out the way you thought, at least you've got the satisfaction of knowing you gave it your best shot.
Well, that's why I always found it so damn cool about you, is you never, ever, ever let anyone tell you what to do or let anyone stand in your way, and you found your own path and you got it done.
Thank you.
All right, more with rock legend Joan Jett and songwriter and producer Kenny Laguna next on 720 WGN.
Bye.
It's Day Player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to rock and roll legend Joan Jett and songwriter and producer Kenny Laguna. Kenny, tell me how you and Joan got together.
I used to be in bubblegum bands, like Tommy Jameson and the Shondells, mm-hmm. Led Zeppelin of bubblegum, and we kind of, this whole group of people that had so many hit records, like Sugar Sugar, Yummy Yummy, Chewy mm-hmm. Chewy, anything like that, Moni Moni, so that ended quickly because we were trying to be something else, a little cooler. Remember, we were AM radio hits, and at the time, then the whole world of FM, where, of course, we still saw Nash and The Who, and you know. So anyway, at the end of it, I luckily got adopted by The Who, and they had a band I produced for them called the Steve Gibbons Band that had hits in Europe, and the publicist, the American publicist, was the manager of The Runaways and Blondie. And he kept telling me I should meet these girls. They're great. And I was intrigued because I just heard that they were wild. And I was more intrigued with that than I was with, you know, the concept of it than the music. Because my style of producing before I met Joan was more like, you know, we came in and figured out what you're going to sound like and create a sound and get a song and just kind of half craft things, you know. It's like Milli Vanilli was no surprise to me because we did that every day, all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, anyway, we had this manager, and the last album was about to happen. So he told me I could go to Amsterdam from London, where I was, and meet with the girls, and if they liked me, I could produce the record. And I was interested. So I was in the Mayfair Hotel, and when I get down to the lobby checking out, I ran into this guy, Matthew King Kaufman, who's he was head of Berserkly Records, one of the new wave pioneers. And he, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm going to go meet with this band, The Runaways. And he goes, oh, they lost their best person. Why don't you come with me to California? And you can produce Greg Kinn and Earthquake and Jonathan Richman. And to tell you the truth, it was winter time, and I had the job. So I drove to the airport with him and went to California.
Yeah.
And I didn't meet The Runaways then. And then in the middle of the album, things were falling apart because Lita Ford and Jack and Sandy West were attaching themselves to producer John Alcock, and they wanted to be a heavy metal band. And Joan was more like, you know, totally enamored with the punk scene and the glam scene. So it was falling apart, and he asked me to come in and finish the album, and again, I didn't. And then by the end of the year, The Runaways had broken up. And I got a call from this fellow, Toby Mamus, who's Alice Cooper's tour manager today, and he said, The Runaways had broken up. They've all left. Remember, I didn't know one from another, but they've all left except Joan Jett, and she's going to fulfill a contract we have with a movie company that's going to sue us if we don't deliver 6 songs in 8 days. And because I had learned the craft of songwriting, I was a good choice to try to create songs quickly.
So here's another guy, my best friend here, Kenny Laguna, we weren't best friends yet, being the same sexist that all these other people were.
Right.
It wasn't a sexist.
No, it was, Kenny. Yes, it was, Kenny. You wanted me to...
We did that with the guy singers, too. It's like,
doesn't matter.
You're the songwriter, artist. You eat overdub. Listen, we did a Bo Diddley record called Bo Diddley 1969, and Bo Diddley didn't play guitar.
That's doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Maybe it's just the way I read it, but you were just saying another line like every other guy did. Like
let
us men do the basic track, and then you can come in and put on your girl guitar. And it was like, dude, I'm on the basic track, or there's no record. That's the way it goes.
My mother was a Greenwich Village communist feminist, Joni. Please.
I know, but that's how it went. Then Kenny got it, and then he saw me play, and then we were on the same team. And I'm sure maybe there wasn't anything sexist in it, but once he saw, you know, it in action, then it was like I had somebody there to fight with me. You know, because I was all alone before that, and I was flailing, and I didn't know what to do or how to continue. How do I do this, you know, when everyone already thinks you're a failure at 18 or 19?
Yeah. And here you are 40 years later.
Yep.
So Joan Jett and the Blackhearts were formed, and you had your first hit, I Love Rock and Roll, which really opened the door to a much wider audience. I assume the experience back then and the immediate success that followed was pretty surreal for you.
It was surreal because we weren't really aware of what was going on. We were just out playing the clubs, and we put out I Love Rock and Roll in November of 2001. Very slow time normally in the record industry, and we just went on the road, and the following year started touring relentlessly like we normally do. And I'm not sure at what point. I think, you know, people were working the records. We had a lot of support. It was in the days when radio used to take requests, and so we had a lot of support from our local WNEW here in New York. There were a couple of stations on Long Island. There was WLIR and WBAB that was very supportive and actually playing, you know, us because we were local. And it gave us, you know, I guess a little edge to actually have our songs on the radio. So when we played gigs in Long Island or in New York or New Jersey, our crowds were growing. And so I can't say enough how big that support from the radio was, and the fact that the kids were calling up and requesting it, and the stations listened and would play
indie labels did not get on the radio. We were the first to do a concert with WNEW, the big rock station in Manhattan, and we were very lucky that at that moment in time the radio stations were maybe fed up with the old wave, and they were like looking for new things, which led to what they called the new wave.
But there's one thing to be said to be heard on radio, but also it was also the dawn of MTV, so people got to see Joan.
You can never know that, you know, that moment in time is.
But David's right. It was one of the first. You were one of the first rock stars. Forget about female rock star. You were one of the first rock stars on MTV.
On MTV,
right.
Absolutely.
When the Runaways broke up, and I was very lost and scared and didn't know what to do. There was a point there for a couple of weeks that I was seriously contemplating joining a branch of the military just to
keep
myself together, you know, because I was worried about what was going to happen to me, you know. I needed to, you know, I thought maybe I'd have to get some discipline. I'd learn a few things. So, you know, I was thinking about that. Then I met Kenny, and he came out to write some songs with me, and I didn't have to go down that path. But it made me realize that all those people are just like me. You know, there's no difference at all. And so later on, you know, when we'd be on the road, I think this started like when we played Germany. We'd be close to our bases over there, and a lot of the enlisted would show up to the show. And, you know, so you're in, you know, Germany or wherever, and you see a lot of American soldiers or troops in the audience, and they're all singing along and being really loud and stuff. And so I think that was how we realized that we were close to bases. And I think some of the commanding officers would also come, and we spoke to them initially.
Well,
about
the AFN, which was a very unusual thing because we didn't start through normal channels.
Right.
And things were a little bit different before all the terrorism. And what we would do is eventually we'd call AFN and tell them, look, we're going to be in Tokyo. We're going to be here. And those guys in Frankfurt, Germany, the AFN people, knew how to reach out to places around the globe. And they would get a CO, and we get into town, get in touch with the CO at the bases, and then go on the bases. And it was a very unusual thing, and eventually it evolved into us being with what they call Armed Forces Entertainment and USO, and that's how it happened over time. But we're always, you know, when our troops were around, it was always great. It was a taste of home for us, and we were a taste of home for them. So we felt this kinship to them, and we loved being in places where our troops were.
And they're great audiences, too, and it's a great way to thank them. It's a great way to thank them.
And, you know, now we have way more of a sense of the sacrifice and the excellence of these guys. I mean, it's like, it's one
and
of the
girls.
Things that really works in our country. Like, even when they had a storm, and Katrina said the only thing that worked was the military.
Joan and Kenny, hey, thanks so much for hanging out with us a little bit tonight.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for having us, Dave.
All right, it's 720 WGN.
Make it through whatever, if we love.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So punk and pop icon Debbie Harry helped rewrite the rules in a field that prided itself on its lack of rules. Blondie was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006, and that is music icon Debbie Harry. Hello there, Debbie.
Hi. How are you, David?
I am thrilled and honored to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's great to be around. We were just out here in L.A. working on new music, so I'm all, you know, stoked.
Very cool. Well, you know, you changed so much in rock and pop music. You were the first female rock singer who was not only beautiful, but extremely talented and just edgy and completely incredibly cool.
Thank you very much. It's a lot to live up to.
No, it's totally true, and you have lived up to that. So, you know, I know, as a teenager, you grew up in suburban New Jersey, and you would venture into the West Village, and you would check out the theater scene when you were younger, and you really wanted to be a part of that. You wanted to be a part of something exciting.
Well, you know, I think I was really trying to explore, you know, what was going on in the art world and in theater, I guess. And I like to read a lot. You know, I'm sort of an avid reader, and you know, seeing all these different articles about the scene in New York, and it all seemed very wonderful and magical to me, so of course I had to go and check it out.
But you know, and I know, and I've seen you do some interviews before. You know, you were kind of, and I've seen you quoted as being saying you were kind of oversexed, really charged, and you really wanted to get out of your suburban town, and that's kind of what ventured you into New York. New York was kind of your calling.
Well, I think so. You know, but I have to honestly say that. You know, even as a tiny little girl, you know, like a, you know, a four-year-old and a five-year-old, I was fortunate enough to live in that area and was taken by my family into the city for big holidays, you know, like a real tourist.
Sure.
And, you know, to go see the big tree at Rockefeller Center, or to go to see the Easter show at Rockefeller, you know, at the theater. So I would... you know, I had those things, you know, be feeding me, you know, sort of the I knew that it was all there, and it was so wonderful and so big, and you know, just such a magnetic force to me that you know, I had to be a part of it.
Well, you moved there in 65, big music scene at the time. You joined a folk group in the late 60s called Wind in the Willows as a backup singer. What got you into that group?
Well, my best friend from high school actually was married to the founder of that band, of that group, and so I was just, you know, hanging around with her, and, you know, he would be writing songs or something like that, and I, you know, started singing like a high harmony or something, and, you know, that's, I just sort of fell into that. I can't really say that I was a creative force in that band or that group.
Well, and you did that. You were a go-go dancer. You were Playboy Bunny for a little bit. But from 69 to 73, you kind of took a little bit of a break, and then you jumped back in. What made you give yourself some breathing room there?
Well, I don't know. I didn't. I guess I had to, you know, find another approach into that thing. I sort of felt uncomfortable in the music business, and I think that it was sort of a case of misdirection at first, and you know, I guess that I didn't really identify with it, you know, creatively, and did not feel comfortable. I felt misrepresented, you know, in that era, I guess, and I had to sort of wait until there was a, you know,
the right thing came along.
Yeah, a big empty spot where something new could be, you know, brought out.
Sure. Well, you joined the Stilettos in 74. You met your longtime collaborator, Chris Stein, and then came Angel and the Snake, and then Blondie. How did Blondie come about?
Well, we had the name Angel and the Snake, and we had, you know, just tossed around different names, and we knew that Angel and the Snake wasn't going to really work. Felt a little too cumbersome and perhaps retro at that time. And so, you know, just Blondie sort of seems so direct and to the point and sort of a little bit weird and crazy after the comic strip. And I don't know, it seems somehow appropriate.
Is that what the name came from?
It was, yeah, well, partially. I think it was just because, you know, I had bleached my hair and,
sure,
you know, people started saying, blah, blondie. So it seemed pretty obvious. I also felt that, you know, when you choose a name like that, you sort of have to find something that's already registers in people's minds.
Sure.
As if you were, you know, trying to do something that's commercial, or, you know, has commercial potential, that, you know, it has to be sort of something that already exists in people's minds, but yet it's, you know, has the potential also to be unique.
And tell me about the music club, the legendary music club, CBGB, country, bluegrass, and blues, that you kind of really broke out in. And I was looking at the lineup. I mean, it was you, it was the Ramones, it was Talking Heads, it was later Elvis Costello, The Police, Joan Jett. What an iconic venue this was.
Yes, it was very exciting. Television came out of there. A lot of Patty played there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of it was quite a good music scene. I think, you know, as, you know, as music scenes go, you know, as with, you know, the San Francisco scene and the LA scene, that they sort of gather momentum, you know, it becomes people are drawn to it, you know, especially musicians, because they want to see what everybody else is doing. So it's sort of like a natural force in a way.
Well, you know, and this was kind of a boys' club. How did you break through? Like, what would you attribute to you breaking through and making a difference? Because, I mean, you really made it, it was groundbreaking.
I think there were a number of us there, not too many, and of course there weren't very many girls in the business then. But, you know, I think it was just an idea whose time had come, you know, and I felt determined. I felt that this was something that I had to do. You know, I had an obsession with it, and I was fortunate in that, you know, I had a wonderful partner, and we had a great time together. And you know, there were really good girls there, though there weren't that many. And you know, I had a stubborn streak. I perhaps still have it.
I like
and,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, well, that's what makes you who you are, though. I mean, you know, I love the edginess about you, and I think that's what has made you. That's part of your success story.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be able to stand up for yourself somehow. You know, it doesn't have to be in the biggest way, and it's surprising. You know, like when you do stand up for something that you really feel you must. It can be something that's very trivial, but it really gives you a great sense of yourself, and I think it's amazing. You just never know where it's going to lead.
That's right. No, that's right. And then your debut album came out in 76, and when I first heard Ripper to Shreds, I was like, wow, is there someone cool enough on the planet to write this? Because it wasn't just about the music. I mean, there's a lot of artists, it's just about the music or it's just about the lyrics. There was a great combination of both.
Yeah, well, it was definitely a tribute, in a way, an homage to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground, with that, you know, the feel of the music. Or we tried to make it like that. It wasn't quite exactly that. It was sort of a combination between punk and Lou Reed. And then the lyric was a sort of a parody, really, self-parody in some respects. And, you know, just sort of what, you know, what people get up to, you know, talking about one another, or, you know, being bitchy.
Mm-hmm.
Get the bitch on.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, then came, you know, Plastic Letters, and came, you know, Parallel Lines, which reached number one in the UK, number six in the US, Heart of Glass, one way or another, you know, sold well over 20 million copies. And then in 79, you were on the cover of Rolling Stone. At what point did you say to yourself, wow, we've made it, we are on our way, this is it? What point of that era did you say that to yourself?
Well, I think, you know, once we started recording, and it was, you know, I mean, nowadays you can record and it, very easily you can do it, but then, you know, you really had to have somebody interested in you via a label or management to make it possible to really record. And I think once we realized that, you know, somebody wanted to record what we were doing, that we were definitely, you know, in it, you know, in it to win it or whatever,
sure.
You know, however
sure.
You want to put it.
Debbie Harry, the underground punk Harlow, is the star of Blondie. She looks the part. The members of Blondie have become important figures, if not heroes, to the dozens of new wave acts seeking widespread acceptance in this country, and the latest overnight sensations in a diverse late 70s rock boom that includes Elvis Costello, The Police, Cars, Dire Straits. The band shattered the new wave stigma of non-commercialism. Since Blondie's inception in 75, Debbie has been a fashion trendsetter as well as a sex symbol. I think you've carried that along through your entire career.
It's quite a mouthful you just...
Yeah, right?
That was quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I always sort of laugh. I'm a little bit mystified, but then I understand, you know, being a fashion trendsetter, I know women that are very chic and very fashionable, and I definitely am not quite that person, but I think what we did was we completely flipped the coin and went in the opposite direction to what the current sort of trends were across the country, and therefore became remarkable. And the second thing that helped me with that was working with a wonderful designer named Steve Sprouse. And he is actually from, I believe he's from Indiana, but I know he spent a lot of time up around the lakes in the summertime.
Oh, cool.
So he's, you know, he's one of you guys.
Yeah, gotcha. Midwesterners here. You know, and here's the thing, too. You know, all this success, and then you were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
Well, of course, you know, being a punk, I had to scoff at it. You know, I had to sort of say, oh, who wants that? You know, but then when it happened, I said, oh, wow, this is kind of great. You know, look at all these great people. And to be a part of that, you know, I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing, really.
And are you, and I'm going to come see you when you're here on Friday, and I have to ask you, you know, are you noticing a mix in your audiences? Is it baby boomers, young people, fans that just want to hear the hits? Like, what are you seeing in the crowds? I have a 15-year-old son who, when I was playing some of the music yesterday, telling him that I was going to talk to you today, and he knows every one of your songs. So, I mean, you're really crossing so many different generations these days.
Yeah, well, I have always appreciated that and loved it, and I think it's one of the things about Blondie that, you know, has been consistent, honestly, since the very beginning, and our record company people back in the dark ages, they always remarked about that our, you know, our demographic was very, very spread. You know, there was no limitation to it. You know, we appealed to a lot of different age groups. So, you know, I can live with that. I think today it's changed in a way, you know, because of the availability of music. It's so easy to get and to, you know, anybody can listen to whatever they want. And I think in radio it has changed too. I think that radio is not so, you know, prescribed, you know,
right.
It's not so, you know, your playlists are much bigger and can cover a lot of different eras. And it really makes sense, you know, it's our culture and it's what we listen to, it's what moves us, it's our daily lives, you know.
Now, you know, on stage and in your songs, because it's an art form, I think, of what you do. You use your sexuality in almost a way that turned into an art form. It was sexual, not vulgar. But how do you feel about some of the new artists who try to copy things like that? I mean, are they hitting the right notes when it comes to that?
I don't know. I'm kind of amazed and in awe of so many of the newer and younger artists. I just think they're sensational music now, and you know, when you see somebody with a strong personality and, you know, putting it, you know, really putting it all in there and where it counts, you know, it, you know, it may not necessarily be my own personal taste, but I always have to, you know, really admire them. You know, I mean, it takes some guts to really get up and to be that person, you know?
Sure. Sure. Before I let you go, I want to ask you this. The official video for Blondie's Heart of Glass on YouTube has been viewed like 49 million times. There's over a million other Blondie videos on YouTube, most of them from unofficial accounts, you know, with hundreds of millions of views. Yet you guys really don't receive a fair amount of royalties from these millions of plays. In fact, it's estimated that YouTube only plays a sixth of what Apple and Spotify pays artists. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think I wrote something about that, and I feel that, you know, that the technology has moved very quickly, and this is something that has been sort of plaguing the industry since since the 60s, really. At least the early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, that the little from going into the cassettes and the DATs and the 8-tracks and so on. I think it's best said by one of the label people years ago said, "Oh my God, they can just copy the music."
Yeah.
like suddenly realized that, you know, anybody could make a copy, you know, and that was it. So I think it's been a deal that's been going on, but it hasn't covered, you know, authorship and writers, you know, hasn't protected the writers and the artists correctly, and I think that's something that has to be remedied, and we will, you know, we have to stand up for our rights.
Absolutely have to, because I'll tell you, if you're selling a piece of artwork and you're copying it, of course you're going to get, that's a federal crime. Like, why isn't, you know, copying music or playing music on certain things something that you should be getting paid for? Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful article that's much more extensive than mine, and the article is extraordinary. It's wonderful. Great language, really in-depth, and well worth reading.
What is your proudest moment in your 40-year-plus history, or are those days yet to come?
Oh. I don't know. You know, I guess some of the bigger festivals that we've played, you know, when it gets over 100,000 people, you know, you just sort of say, "What the, you know, what is this?"
Yeah, yeah.
that's kind of it. Just the power of that is so exciting, and you just, it's, you know, it just makes you want to melt, really.